Thank you. I hope not to put you to sleep with the lights in
there. There you go.
Okay. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
I was expressed my honor to be here speaking to you. My own grandfather was a member of this chapter of the Ethical Society before he passed. So it's an honor here to continue his legacy. Today I'd like to, as the introducer mentioned, I'd like to go into a little history of the two Koreas, because I think it's something that's left out of news accounts of the nuclear crisis. And then I want to focus a bit on the divergence in the two countries since their division in 1945. Up until 1945, of course, they were all one Korea. And so it's interesting to look at the commonalities that continue in a country that was unified since the 7th century AD, and then to juxtapose that with the changes over 70 years. 70 years doesn't seem like a long time, but indeed in that time, two distinct countries and two distinct languages actually have emerged. Then I want to look at the perspective of the U.S. in the North Korean official ideology and media. And then I will conclude with an overview of the current state, including the recent Winter Olympics and the summit between the U.S. and North Korea. So first off, reasons for division, selection of leaders in the North Sphere and the Southern Sphere, and post-war policies in each country. Also, as I said, the depiction of the war in North Korea and in South Korea and the U.S., linguistic divergence, and finally, prospects for unification. I'd like to start out, though, with a brief analysis of the recent so-called candlelight revolution, which I witnessed there when I was there in Seoul from 2016 to 2017. These are pictures that I snapped there in October of 2016. This was a protest that emerged in September, but it really started to gain steam in October. This was the first time. It was every Friday night they staged this protest. This was the first one where it actually topped 1 million people. This is in Gwanghwamun, the main square in downtown Seoul. This is where traditionally the protests and other big events have been held. It's hard from pictures to get a sense of just the massive number of people at this protest, but it was at points there were so many people that I was lifted off my feet by just this surge of humanity. But at no time did I feel unsafe or did I sense any sort of violent tendencies among any of the protesters. It was, on the whole, completely nonviolent and very well organized. You can see the candle lights there. This was this came about based on reports of corruption among the Park Geun-hye administration when it came out that those without government security clearance were given access by the president to top-secret documents, and then more and more reports of other corruption, collusion with Chaebol's CEOs, conglomerates came to light, and this is what eventually toppled the leader. Here you see on this poster some of the demands of the protest movement. The first one is the president should resign. There should be an independent investigation. Two, another big part of this was the so-called downing of the sinking of the Sewol ferry. I don't know if you heard about this on the news back in 2014, where most of the passengers were high school students on a field trip, and hundreds of students and others died, and there were reports of corruption, again, collusion between the South Korean government and the ferry provider to cut corners in the production of such boats, and there was overcrowding on the boats. There were more passengers than were allowed by law, and so this was also part of the protesters' demands, independent investigation into this. And also, number six there is about the nationalization of history textbooks that the Popkin Hay administration did, which was highly unpopular. This picture here gives you a sense of just how many people were in the square. A man taking a break amid demonstrations. These were students who had climbed to the top of a news truck. And in the background there, you see one of the old heroes of ancient Korea, Admiral Lee Soo-shin, who repelled the Japanese. Here's a banner about the opposition party to the president, saying Park Geun-hye should resign. Their party should also be held accountable, but it is telling that it is an opposition party, this banner. Here's a woman wearing a guillotine hat. I just had to take a picture of this hat, my favorite hat. And here's my my friend from Mizzou in my college days, who was from South Korea. We reconnected during that year, and here we are at the protest. So, why do I bring up this protest? Well, I'd like to contrast it with the situation in the DPRK. Now, in North Korea's own capital, in the main square, they also have big meetings like this, but of course not demonstrations. They're orchestrated by the state. You're more likely to see in the center of town that looks like this. Stark contrast to downtown Seoul. As you see from a satellite image, this blackened area here is North Korea at night and wow. South Korea at day.
Wow.
Yeah.
Holy cow.
Even China has much more lights. So how did we get here? I'd like to start by talking about the selection of leadership in the North and South in 1945, because I think this laid the groundwork for how we got to where we are today. This is a picture of Syngman Rhee, Lee Sun-man, the first president of South Korea, and General Douglas MacArthur in the middle, and John Hodge, the leader of the occupation from 1945 to 1948. So Syngman Rhee was quite old when he took office in 1945. He had a classical education, meaning in classical Chinese in the traditional style. But then he entered Paige School, which was a missionary school set up by missionaries in Korea in 1894. And from that time on, he went to get a Western education. First, a BA at George Washington University in 1907, an MA at Harvard just a year later, and a PhD from Princeton just 2 years later. I don't know how he did this, but by all accounts, he was a brilliant scholar, brilliant politician. He was one of the first to receive a Western education, in fact. And from 1904 to 1910, and then again from 1912 to 1945, mostly in Hawaii, he carried out independence activities. These were mostly attempts to forge bonds, connections with politicians in the United States who would eventually support Korea's bid for independence from Japan. The annexation of Korea, by the way, happened in 1910. So while he was working in the United States, working to get U.S. support for independence, there were other independence activists in Korea, but mostly in Manchuria and China. And this will bring us later to the leader in North Korea, Kim Il-sung. So what was the Usamgik ruling strategy from 1945 to 1948? This was during the U.S. occupation. Usamgik is U.S. military forces in Korea. So the post-war American ascendancy to superpower status was aided primarily by the threat of global communism. The Korean War was really the first flashpoint in the Cold War. It was mainly guided by this same threat. So it's important to understand USAMKA policy in South Korea as primarily driven by anti-communism, preventing the spread of communism in South Korea. And in 1945, communism was a big threat in South Korea, as you can see by the way North Korea went. Priority was given to anti-communist credentials for leadership rather than nationalist credentials. Now, it could be argued that Lee Seung-man was a nationalist and anti-communist, but lower leadership, many of them had colluded with Japan. But to the US forces, it was not so important that they were previously pro-Japanese. More important was that they were anti-communist. And this came to dictate how the leadership in South Korea was formed. One characteristic of the occupation was the unpreparedness of the US, utterly. They were simply not ready or really willing for such an occupation, but it was mostly to forestall Soviet occupation of the entire peninsula that they took on this role. Here's a statement by Langdon, one of the occupation leaders, advisor to Hodge, who we saw in the previous picture. Quote, as for favoring plutocracy in and excluding popular left-wingers from military government, it is quite probable that at the beginning we may have picked out a disproportionate number of rich and conservative persons. For practical purposes, we had to hire persons who spoke English, and it so happened that these persons and their friends came largely from moneyed classes, because English had been a luxury among Koreans. This was one of the main criteria for choosing who the US would work with, simply the ability to speak English. The US had practically no Korean experts whatsoever. They knew little about Korea, and very few among the occupation could speak Korean, so it simply fell on those Koreans who could speak English. This is a quote from Proclamation No. 1 by the USAMKA forces in Korea. Quote, for all purposes, during the military control, English will be the official language, and in the event of any ambiguity or diversity of interpretation or definition between an English, Korean, or Japanese text, the English text shall take precedence. Remember, Korea had just been a Japanese colony for 36 years, and most of the documents were in Japanese. Korean had been outlawed from the late 1930s, 1940s. So most of it was in Japanese, and so much of what the US was using was Japanese translated into English. This, however, fed into a North Korean myth of American imperialist policy to, quote, obliterate the Korean language, end quote. This is what the North Korean regime has used for many years. It's part of the larger narrative that South Korea is occupied by the US, and a war against South Korea would be a war to liberate South Korea from US occupation. And part of that is the Americans' attempt to obliterate the Korean language by creating this hodgepodge sort of hybrid with all these English neologisms, English loanwords, which is not really true, but there are very many English loanwords in South Korean speech, and this is one reason, as I'll show later in the speech, that North Korean defectors have a hard time making it in South Korea because there are just so many English loanwords in the language. So now we turn north to Kim Il-sung, the first leader. He was born Kim Song-ju. Kim Il-sung is actually a nom de guerre, his war name, that he took on as a guerrilla fighter in Manchuria in the 1930s. His parents were actually church-going Presbyterians. This is against the official narrative of the Kim dynasty that is anti-religion in any way, but he actually grew up Christian. His father attended Sushil Middle School, a Presbyterian mission school. He was educated actually almost completely in Chinese. Most of his education happened in Manchuria. He only has 1 year of education in Korean. Had. And as I mentioned, he was a guerrilla fighter in Manchuria from 1932 to 1940. So there is a kernel of truth in his narrative of resistance against the Japanese. But since 1945, the North Korean regime has run with this kernel of truth and created a complete sort of hagiography, a massive narrative that he and his guerrilla band single-handedly liberated the whole Korea from Japanese oppression. From 1940 to 45, this is important, he joined the Soviet Army, and this is how he eventually got backing to be installed as the first leader of North Korea. Here he is at a meeting with his Soviet clients in 1946 in Pyongyang. He joins the 88th Brigade in USSR in 1940. There, he wasn't involved in actual combat against the Japanese. He was involved in reconnaissance. Here, he cultivated Chinese and Soviet allies, which would be important later for him. And Kim's time in the USSR is not part of the current official North Korean narrative. Again, the official narrative has it that he and his band single-handedly liberated Korea from the Japanese. Earlier on in the 1940s, there was acknowledgement of Soviet help, but since then, that has been removed from the narrative. It's all about the Kim dynasty. So unlike in the South, in the North, Japanese collaborators were largely excluded from leadership, even at lower levels. There was also an effective campaign to stamp out illiteracy in the North. By international estimates, by even Soviet estimates, before 1950, the war, it was completely eliminated in North Korea. And this was substantial because in 1945, more than 60% of North Koreans were illiterate. So to go from 60% to zero in 5 years is quite an accomplishment. In South Korea as well, there were strides made, but not nearly as dramatic as in the North. There was also sweeping land reform carried out in North Korea. And it was largely successful because from 1945 to 1950, most of the landowners left North Korea because of the policies. And so it was easy just to confiscate their land because there were no landowners. So this was very popular among the public, and it provided the North Korean regime a strong foundation for moving forward with other reforms. In the South, however, the USAMKit position was that land reform should be carried out by Koreans. However, when the leadership is stacked with conservative landowners, not as much land reform happened in the South. Some did, but not like in the North. Overall, while USAMKit had to fight an uphill battle against communism in the South, the Soviets had only to step aside and let these forces run their course. This, I think, is the biggest reason why the reforms, well, the Soviets had a lot easier time in the North than the U.S. did in the South. So, quick timeline. August 15th, 1945, Japan surrenders. Less than a week prior to this, the USSR had declared war on Japan. So, technically, the Soviets were only fighting Japan for about a week. They didn't really see many battles. But they used this as a pretext to occupy the northern part of the peninsula. Soviet forces occupied Korea north of the 38th parallel, and American forces to the south. This decision to divide was made by Colonels Dean Rusk and Charles Bonesteel. They drew a rather arbitrary line late one night. The main reason for this was so that the Soviets would not occupy the entire peninsula. The Soviets were positioned closer to the Korean Peninsula at this time. The American forces were still in Japan and would take another couple of days to get to the Korean Peninsula. So it was a quick decision. They didn't actually think that the Soviets would accept this line, but they did. And this is really the reason why we have a divided decree right now. U.S. occupation forces, meanwhile, refused to recognize people's committees that had sprung up. Right after liberation in 1945, Korean people took it upon themselves to create their own provisional governments in provinces across the peninsula. In the north, these were acknowledged. In the south, they were not. U.S. forces simply ignored them and set up their own occupation. Then U.S. called for U.N. mediation to hold free elections in the whole peninsula. The Soviets boycott these elections. The Soviets said the U.N. has no jurisdiction. And so this was the beginning of the end for the permanent division of the peninsula. After this point, the two superpowers dug in and hopes of reunifying the peninsula were diminished. Then on August 15, 1948, the Republic of Korea is established, South Korea, and Syngman Rhee becomes first president. Then shortly after, a few weeks after, the DPRK is established with Kim Il-sung as premier.
What's DPRK?
Democratic People's Republic of Korea. Then the Korean War breaks out from 1950 to 1953, and as you know, we still have an armistice, not a peace treaty, so it is technically still an ongoing war. Although to live in South Korea, you wouldn't know that. Here's a short overview of the major changes in the Korean War. Here's on the eve of war, the North Korean regime, Kim Il-sung, invades. This was mainly Kim's decision to do this. And he pleaded with the leader of China to let him do this. He didn't want to at first. He gets material support from the Soviets and some from China, but this was mostly North Korea troops only at this time. The unprepared South is pushed by September of that year down to the Busan perimeter. Then, with the infamous MacArthur Incheon landing, they push back up to the Chinese border. And MacArthur is calling to hit targets in China across the border. And so China gets anxious about this and enters with hundreds of thousands of Chinese troops. And it would be a couple months before MacArthur actually acknowledges that he's fighting Chinese troops, and they're not all North Korean. So they pushed back down here, and then finally, in 1953, the armistice is signed. Most of the fighting over 2.5 years happened around the border today that separates the two countries. So what does the North believe about the war? I think it's important. It's critical to look at this to explain their behavior on the international stage. This is one of the many propaganda posters that, until recently, you would have seen. One, the United States committed war crimes during the Korean War. The Korean War was begun by the U.S. This is what everyone in North Korea believes. This is the official line. And more importantly, to invade the South would be to liberate South Korea from U.S. occupation. Here in this picture, you see a U.S. soldier, I think a Japanese soldier, the old Joseon scholar here. They're all enemies of the modern state. South Korea has since been occupied by an imperial power, the United States, and war, as I said, would be righteous unification. Here's another propaganda poster. I think this one was at a kindergarten. Playing "Take Out the Americans, the Game is Fun." I read a report this morning, interestingly, though, that an international worker in Pyongyang has reported that all of these propaganda posters have disappeared. The anti-U.S. ones. Now the ones that you see are just simply pro-regime, let's do it. But anti-U.S. probably, it's sudden, I know. Here's another propaganda poster, a recent one that you would have seen. This this references recent rhetoric in U.S. media. This is Korea's answer, it says here. And then these words down in the rubble are sanctions, preventative war, preventative strike, when this was being talked about in the U.S. media, military option. This is would be North Korea's answer to U.S. rhetoric.
That's the Capitol building.
Yeah, that's the Capitol building. And then up here, the translation is, you cannot stop our forward advance. And then on this wheel, this track of the tank, it says economic development. Here it says nuclear missile development. In the middle, it says parallel advancement. This is not just empty rhetoric. This actually describes their policy up until probably now, but up until recently, that nuclear missile development is not just as a deterrence. It's a parallel policy in line with economic development. Those two things are connected. This is the official state line. And then down here in the rubble, you see more U.S. rhetoric, pressure, sanctions, preventative war. These would all crumble under our policy. Another common propaganda poster that this is from the war era, Korean War era, is the demonic Korean, American soldier. It's interesting to note, though, in these propaganda posters that I've never seen any posters that target just a normal-looking American person. It's always a U.S. soldier or the Capitol building. It's never just an American-looking person. It's important because the U.S. soldier is the symbol of U.S. imperialism for them in Korea, and so that's their target. Showing these posters is not to, you know, it's not to rile up anti-North Korean sentiment. I think it's really important to understand that these posters mean something. They reflect policy, and it's important to understand why they're produced and how they explain the actions of North Korea. This is an interesting poster from South Korea. This is the appropriation of that same kind of propagandistic style. Do you know who this is?
No.
This is the recently deposed leader of South Korea, Park Geun-hye. This poster was made by a group of university students in South Korea. It says here, pro-Japan and pro-America. She was seen as being onward to nationalize textbooks. History war, this has to do with the nationalized history textbooks that I mentioned earlier. Utmost dignity. And these, if you know Korean, you can tell that they're using the North Korean spelling of the language very cleverly. And they're using vocabulary that's used in North Korea, not in South Korea. It's a very clever appropriation of that the language and the style. And then at the bottom it says, paid for by the great Blue House leader admiring women comrades. So it's appropriating like Stalinistic language to, in this case, not to denigrate North Korea, but to denigrate their own president.
Who was the president again?
Park Geun-hye.
What's that, he?
She. First woman president in South Korea.
No. Was the objection to the nationalizing of the textbooks, they were objecting to the government taking over the textbooks?
Yes.
And controlling the narrative?
Yes, correct.
Okay.
Yeah. Not allowing any other kind of
interpretations.
Textbooks. Yeah. Very conservative interpretation of Korean history. Yeah. Okay, let's look at the two countries since the war. There was a historic development imbalance due to colonialism. Because of Japanese policy on the peninsula, most of the energy production was put in the northern part of the peninsula, and most of the agrarian area was in the south. And so when it was divided so arbitrarily, the north got all the industry, or most of it, most of the energy production. The south got most of the population, they got the capital. But because of this, there was this immediate imbalance between the countries. And this affected the development of the countries moving forward. forward. This is why in the 60s and early 70s, North Korea production was actually higher than South Korea. They did better than the South for a couple decades after division. The North received Chinese and Russian aid, while South Korea, of course, received U.S. aid, massive U.S. aid. They remained roughly comparable, the economies, until the early 70s. Here you can see. So it looks like the lines are pretty even up until 1970, but this covers up the massive amount of U.S. aid. Through the 50s and early 60s, U.S. aid was really just propping up the country, and it wasn't developing as much as it could its industry. So actually, the blue line should look a little higher in the 50s, especially in the 50s and then 60s. So as for the languages, in South Korea was a laissez-faire approach. It was continued usage of Chinese characters, widespread use. Until only recently, they were very widespread in South Korea. There was, as I mentioned, heavy importation of English. By one account, in 1991, 10,000 new English loanwords had been adopted as Korean words, just pronounced in a Korean way. Since then, easily 20,000 more. In the North, on the other hand, language was a tool for revolution. This, I think, was the big reason for the elimination of illiteracy so quickly in the North. They needed the population to be able to read so they could spread propaganda and indoctrinate the population. Chinese characters were immediately done away with. Only vernacular script was used. So in Korean, traditionally, there was a mixture of what's called Hangul, the Korean alphabet, and Chinese characters today. So it's Korean, but some Chinese characters are thrown in, kind of like Japanese, like a mixture. But from 1949, in the North, they did away with all the Chinese characters, used only their own alphabet, and they still do today. In the South, though, is very different. This was a utilitarian and functionalist philosophy to linguistics, to language. They needed people literate so that they could indoctrinate them. By another report in 1991, 50,000 new words were created in the DPRK. New words. This was a state-directed campaign to create purely Korean words, that is, to do away with sort of Chinese-influenced words, what would be like Latin base words in English, to do away with them and to create entirely new, purely Korean words.
Did I hear you correctly?
Yes.
That in the South, they wanted to keep the people illiterate in order to indoctrinate them?
No, in the North.
In the North. Okay.
Yeah. Yes.
They wanted them to be literate.
They needed to be able to spread the message. They wanted them to be able to read the messages,
yeah,
that they were controlling the message.
This was another reason, and they say as much in their own rhetoric in the North. This was a reason to do away with Chinese characters and to use only like the alphabet, because it's easier to read. This was to move the revolution forward in their language. Here's an example of sort of a linguistic hygienity, you could say. There were magazines dedicated to creating the proper North Korean language, creating the proper role, the proper, what's a good word, the proper method of expressing revolutionary language correctly. These are from the 80s. There were magazines dedicated to this. These are specific modifiers that were used in this magazine to describe the proper North Korean revolutionary woman. Courteous, polite, respectful, modest, plain, simple, frugal, elegant, refined, sophisticated, beautiful, kind, friendly, etc. And on the left there are the Korean terms. Neat, tidy, harmonious, amicable, close, familiar, intimate, full of deep affection, but then at the bottom also, revolutionary. So this was the way, according to state-produced magazines, that the proper North Korean revolutionary woman should comport herself and speak. According to the leader, quote, women should be womanlike. Courteous, plain, and simple speech, actions, and comportment raise one's dignity and make it possible to be respected and trusted. This is from a magazine for women. It looks like it could be from the 1950s, but it's actually from 2008. And there were also, you know, simply understood cartoons that show proper interaction between husband and wife. Getting ready for work in the morning. Who polished my shoes? Oh, I did it while I was getting ready. Oh, thank you. Let's go to work. Okay. And one more thing on language. I mentioned earlier the myth of a U.S. policy to obliterate Korean. This is from a quote in the 1960s from Kim Il-sung, who mentions this myth. He says, through the policy of extermination of the Korean language of the American imperialists, our language is gradually losing its purity and turning into a gibberish mixture. And here is the a romanization of a text in Korean. This is the North taking an excerpt from a magazine in the South and showing their people, like, this is the way South Koreans speak. It's terrible. It's a gibberish mixture. And the bolded terms are English loanwords. Miss Kim은 Orient Electric 사의 근무. And so you can see, Miss Kim works at the Orient Electric Company. On the way home from work, she did some shopping at the Cosmos department store. And they're using this as an example to show what America has done to South Korean language. But they do have a point that the languages have diverged. And the biggest complaint that North Korean defectors in South Korea have about the language is the sheer number of English loanwords. Because, of course, in North Korea, they don't use any of them. But more and more English is flooding into South Korean. And a company has actually developed a translator, a North South Korean language translator. And I have a short clip of that.
Able to communicate without barriers through this translator, perhaps that day would come just a little sooner.
So, one example you could see of these invented words in North Korea was the first example, ice cream, right? The South Korean woman says ice cream. That's an example of an English loanword. But then the North Korean man, boy, says odumkwaja. Odumkwaja was an artificially created term by North Korea based on pure Korean. It means like frozen crackers and frozen treat or something. So that's an example. But it's interesting at the end, I don't know if you caught it, that they both say the North Korean word. They don't both say South Korean, the ice cream. They both say the North Korean word. So it's a subtle message.
Is the North Korean viewed as more pure, closer to the original language, possibly?
It's hard to say. By yes and no, because the original language used a lot of Chinese, even though at that time it wasn't considered foreign. Only recently is the Sino-Korean, the Chinese-Korean words considered more foreign. So it's complicated. It's a good question. Depends on who you're asking.
Yeah.
Another interesting trend in South Korean media that I noticed is this putting on display of North Korean defectors. It used to be 10 years ago when I lived in South Korea, there were a lot of foreigners on South Korean TV talking about their lives in South Korea. And it was kind of like a novelty to see foreigners speaking Korean and talking about life in Korea. Now it has shifted. Now the new other, the new kind of exotic person on TV is North Korean defectors. And there are talk shows where North Korean defectors get on and they talk about how the countries are different, their experiences in South Korea. So let me show you that video now. Short clip. So this is a North Korean defector.
Yeah.
talk show.
That's the style of the talk show. So it's interesting that the nature of defectors has changed, right? It used to be where lower class would defect, but now it's becoming too expensive and only middle class, increasingly only middle class can defect. So let's move to the current situation and talk about prospects for unification. These are the results of a survey from 2016. These are among South Korean students and students that defected from North Korea. So according to South Korean students, they think it's somewhat necessary, 43% do. Not very necessary, very necessary, only 22% think very necessary. On the other hand, North Korean students, among them, 85% think it's very necessary. Now, young Koreans are among the population most opposed, actually, to unification, because they feel like the brunt of the costs of reunification would fall on them. Already in a country with very high unemployment and even higher semi-employment, they're not very open to the prospects of unification. Now, most are not actually sternly against it, but they're very skeptical. Here's another pie chart showing the possibility of reunification. 65.9% think it's possible, 25.7% think impossible, and the rest don't know. So this is slightly more encouraging, but far from resounding support. How long would this take? The majority of Koreans think that it will take a long time. Very few think it will happen in the short term.
This is North and South Koreans?
This is South Koreans, sorry. Only the first one surveys North Koreans. These are South Koreans. Just the general population. Okay, let's move on to the nuclear issue. Here's a chart showing the number of nuclear tests. This color shows a missile launch. The orange shows missile launch more than 2,000 kilometers. And this little symbol is underground nuclear tests. You can see they've ramped up considerably under the current Kim Jong-un regime. So what's the word on the street? I talk about this a lot with my South Korean friends, what they think about this whole issue. Most South Koreans do not think about North Korea very often. Maybe you've heard this before. Living so close to it, 70 years, they're sort of desensitized, I think, to these provocations. The North Korean crisis and the North are portrayed very differently in the U.S. and South Korea. Of course, you might suspect that, but in South Korea and other countries I've seen, the North is portrayed more as an actual country instead of just a pariah state, a threat, which it is in some respects, but the nature of the portrayal is slightly different. Many South Koreans are actually more concerned with President Trump than they are with the North. Now, this is not to say that they think that Kim Jong-un is a better person or treats his people better, but he's a known quantity in that if you look at the behavior of North Korea under Kim Jong-un, it's nothing new. What they've been doing since the 60s is pretty much their same playbook now. In that sense, North Korea is actually pretty predictable and pretty rational, I would say. What makes it sort of a wild card is that we know so little about it, right? That's what fuels this rhetoric in U.S. media that they're irrational and crazy, because we simply don't know. But if you look at their actual behavior on the world stage, it's pretty predictable. Trump, on the other hand, is not, he's unpredictable. And that concerns them, and I think a lot of people. So let's move on to the Trump-Kim summit. I think that due to Trump's ignorance, he may have actually come up with something positive. People talk about the concessions to sit with the North Korean leader, like that was a major concession. This has been the position of many administrations not to even meet with North Korea, but I don't think it's been a productive policy. I think it's time to accept the fact that the North Korean regime is not going anywhere in the near future, and we better treat them like an actual country to get anything done. The only thing that is going to improve the state of North Koreans is, short of, you know, regime change, short of the regime falling, which I don't think it will, is to promote economic development in the country. That's the only thing that has any chance of improving the lives of people. At this point, economic development is just for survival for North Korea. But I think if it spread to the point where they make irrevocable changes in their economy, it could have a eventual positive benefit. As I mentioned, I don't think it's really a concession to meet with the leader of North Korea. And the other concession that was made was to do away with the joint military drills. And this is not really a big concession. This was something on the table under Clinton. Obama considered it for a short time. To do away with these military drills, I think it's a good thing. And if you look at media portrayals in Asia, in South Korea particularly, they think this is a good thing too. Conservative elements in South Korea always supported the joint drills, but I think more liberal elements and the public in South Korea is against these drills. And so I think it's a good thing. I tried to look at it from the other side. If North Korea and China were conducting these drills on the border, we would go insane. It's the same thing. So I think it's ultimately a good thing to do away with this. What we have now is perhaps the best of several bad scenarios. So it's not perfect, but hopefully there are some irreversible changes that last beyond our current administration that will yield more fruit in the future. So what is the North want? This is my opinion again. They want to be left alone. If you look at their behavior since the 50s, it's calibrated to keep every other country out, to keep their country isolated. This is the only way that they can survive. They want to continue to extract concessions from the outside world, again, for survival. They want to maintain their nuclear weapons and not use them. I doubt that they will give up their nuclear weapons, even with a security guarantee from the U.S. They would maintain some sort of nuclear capability, the current regime. They want to keep their population ignorant, alive, and desperate, but not dangerously so. People talk about a revolution led by the people. I don't really think there's a class of people to lead such a revolution. I don't think there's a civil society in North Korea that would fill the void. The state is everything. Population has no guns or really any kind of organizational capability, so I don't see any kind of revolution happening. Economic development is for regime survival at this point, not for the general population's welfare, but if economic reforms were to continue, it could eventually benefit the population. I want to end today with a quote recently from Victor Cha, who is turned down for a position in the Trump administration. And he's repeating a lot of this rhetoric that I hear in the U.S. media about North Korea. He wrote, quote, "While our population in Japan might be protected by U.S. missile defenses, the U.S. population in South Korea, let alone millions of South Koreans, has no similar active defenses against a barrage of North Korean artillery, aside from counterfire artillery. Sorry. To be clear, the president would be putting at risk an American population the size of a medium-sized U.S. city, Pittsburgh, say, or Cincinnati, on the assumption that a crazy and undeterrable dictator will be rationally cowed by a demonstration of U.S. kinetic power." Again, it's this repetition of the crazy, unpredictable regime, and I simply don't think it is. I think it's rational. And there's this tendency in U.S. media, I guess it's understandable to a point, to only think about how the nuclear weapons would affect the U.S. population in the U.S. We forget about soldiers in South Korea, and we forget about, frankly, our friends and allies in South Korea. They would bear the brunt of any attack. And the brunt would come not from a nuclear attack, but from conventional artillery from the North. This would be devastating to our friends in South Korea. And some of us, you know, have family there. And it's really important to keep it in perspective. It's not only about the U.S., how it threatens us. It's about our friends and allies in the world. I'll stop there. Thank you.